Hey everyone, it's me, Dr. Smina Rahman, your gyno girl. Welcome back to another episode of Sex, Drugs, and Hormones, where we talk about everything about women's health, hormones, and sexual wellness. And maybe you haven't heard some of this before, so hopefully. I just finished interviewing someone, one of my favorite topics, and it's really revolves around what it means to truly embrace sexual wellness. Not just sex itself, but how we connect with ourselves and our partners mentally, emotionally, and physically. So joining me today is the incredible Dr. Jennifer Littner. She is a certified sex therapist, licensed marriage and family therapist, and sexuality educator. She's the founder of Embrace Sexual Wellness right here in Chicago, and she's helped individuals and couples move past shame, anxiety, and disconnection for over a decade. Jennifer also is the creator of the course Building Ease, talking about the birds and the bees, a brilliant resource that helps caregivers talk to kids about bodies, consent, and relationships with confidence. So you guys will hopefully enjoy this discussion. We talk a lot about shame and sex and embracing wellness and teaching the next generation. So I hope you guys are able to get something out of it today and then learn where you can meet Jennifer too. So let's get at it. All right, let's go. Hey y'all, it's me, Dr. Smina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Welcome to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm a sex med gynecologist and menopause expert in downtown Chicago. And I have my own practice called the GYN and Sexual Medicine Collective, which is now Concierge. I'm super excited to bring you guys another episode today. And, you know, you guys heard in my intro who we're going to have the pleasure of speaking with today. You know, we are going to dive into some of our favorite topics, really about embracing sexual wellness. So joining me today is the incredible Dr. Jennifer Littner. Which I don't like.
Hi.
So awesome to meet you. You guys heard the intro about what she does and who she is. So I'm just super excited that you're here. We met in person, I think, at Ishwish initially, right? Was it? Yeah. Was it last year?
It was last year, yeah. February, March. The last weekend of February in Atlanta.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, awesome. And so I talk about Ishwish a lot on this platform. So the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health, which is multidisciplinary, includes sex therapists, pelvic floor therapists, all types of MDDOs, NPs, PAs, medical, sexual educators, you know, researchers, scientists, everything. So it's a great organization. And we got to meet and we had you in the office recently to kind of just like reintroduce each other and just know how we can collaborate on patients, which is very exciting.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
It's always good to be in your company.
Awesome. Well, you know what, before we get into any of the really heavy stuff, I love to start with this question. And I love to find out like why people end up in this location that we are in the junction of sexual medicine and everything. But what inspired the name Embrace Sexual Wellness? Because with that word embrace, you know, it says so much maybe about even how you might approach your work.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so often in the sexuality field, things are often named just like women's health, right? Or men's health, which feels, of course, very binary.
Yeah.
And also there, like a lot of things related to sexual health companies don't actually have the word sex in them.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really important to name what we do and what we're actually really trying to help people accomplish.
Yeah.
So for me, like, even though there are challenges with censorship as a sexuality professional, with using the word sex in our name, we often go by Embrace or ESW, it felt really important to name what we're doing, which is really helping people embrace getting into their sexual wellness more. And that, you know, for some people is more about like enhancing their relationship or addressing the sexual dysfunction. For other people, it's, you know, about working through some intimacy and relationship concerns. Mm-hmm. But no matter what it is, I think it's important to just name it and be transparent.
Absolutely. I love that. There's that power in naming things. We always talk about like sort of affect labeling and sort of the power of naming things to kind of like almost disempower the thing that you're naming, right? Like it's almost like trying to battle it out.
Yeah.
But I love that. And I love that what you're doing. You know, I think that there's so many times where, you know, we see patients, and you probably see this as well, that kind of get stuck in the idea of shame, the shame around sex, the same shame around some of these health concerns. Like, what does sexual shame look like with the people that you work with?
Yeah. I mean, I think first off, it's nervousness and getting on a call or, you know, reaching out, right? It takes so much courage to reach out to a sex therapist. And I don't think people realize that until they actually go through it. You know, it's like the first time you're asking someone out or trying to have your first kiss. Like, if you can remember those feelings, right? But it's like, this is not about a relationship that you're building in intimacy. It's about, you know, seeking care.
Yeah.
And I think people already feel nervous going to the doctor. And we are a very subspecialty within mental health. And so there is a piece around this that feels like very stigmatizing and scary for people too. So I think that's where I first see shame develop. And then, you know, once we're getting into the work, a lot of it's like, hey, I feel insecure about my body. I feel insecure about the number of partners I've had or how experienced I am. I feel insecure because a partner told me that the way that I interacted with them sexually just like didn't feel good. And so I then therefore don't think I can feel, you know, like competent as a sexual partner moving forward. So there's a lot of different ways it can show up. And then, you know, it's a lot of it's based on messaging from how people are raised. So purity culture is a big phenomenon I see in my practice too. And I think, you know, it teaches people that, like, you know, if we grew up thinking we were a chewed up piece of gum, if we were to have sex, right, that's going to affect you. Even when you're, you know, even if you're together and married and happily in a relationship, right? Like, and it's acceptable for you to be sexual. There's this whole piece that kind of feels like a disconnect for a lot of people.
Totally. And I think, you know, especially for, you know, we see it in different cultures within women of color, like it's not just personal. It's like almost intergenerational, right? Like it's just a retaught 100%. Shame over and over again. Is that kind of how you see it play out within cultures and families too?
Absolutely. I'm trained as a marriage and family therapist before I'm a specialist, and we see everything in systems theory, right? Yeah. So the systems that we're a part of. And I think that we inherit some of these like beliefs, right? We don't come out of the womb thinking that sex is bad, right? But we learn this by all the things that reinforce it, right? So maybe it's our family members or caregivers, maybe it's the religious community we're a part of or the social community, our peers, what's taught to us or not taught to us. I can't tell you how many people who didn't learn anything about sex, was never talked about, and how much shame that has actually caused as a result, and not because of what was said. It's because it wasn't talked about, right? Yeah. We have more shame in that kind of thing. So I absolutely agree with you about that.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I think with family dynamics and the shame around, you know, just bringing it up, there takes a lot of courage for so many patients. Even like, I'm sure you see this when I think about some of my pelvic floor dysfunction patients who have significant vaginismus, who have unconsummated relationships. And it takes them so long to get to the point where they can actually show up at your door, my door, whatever. And I get it. I feel like it's, you know, you think it's naturally just kind of magically happen one day. Like it's, oh, it'll happen. Mm-hmm. It'll happen. And then by the time 2 years go by or whatever, you know, some people experience, it doesn't happen. And then what do they do about it? And so I think it's so interesting that they can finally get the courage to come. But then I find like they ghost me for a while once they figure, like they'll come and then I'm like, no, I can't do that again, you know. But once I think they have, you know, because most of these people are super educated. Like I have a lot of, you know, other clinicians and doctors and, you know, whatever that are experiencing this. And so it's not even a lack of, you know, education or knowledge, but maybe within the realm of this and your own body, like you're just uneducated about yourself.
Yeah. And I think there's a really big difference in being able to say, like, I accept that, you know, other people can have sex in this way or this can feel comfortable for them. But when I go to do it, it feels I am hit with this emotional block that I'm just really stuck with. And I think that is really, really hard, especially for really high functioning folks or folks who are really, really educated, right? It's like we manage so much in our lives. How come we can't manage this? And I see a lot of that in my practice too. And just a ton of validation that like this stuff is hard and sometimes we do need some added support.
Yeah. I mean, sex education, I think in general, is wasted on teenagers. You know, like it should be really, like we should have adult sex education, which I think my, our colleague and friend Kelly Casperson always says, like we should have adult sexual education stuff. But
100%. And there's a huge impact on our relationships. My doctoral research really focused on that. I looked at how comprehensive sex ed impacts our relationship satisfaction and turns out it makes a big difference. So what happens with our bodies, getting prepared for that wedding night that you feel mm-hmm. like you're going to consummate this because you were taught in all the Hallmark movies that that's what's supposed to happen and then it doesn't happen. Yeah. Like, of course you're going to feel a sense of shame, right? You're going to think something's wrong with you. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, like, having known that it might not be so great the first time, or you're going to want to do some stretching first, or, you know, any of the other things that we ought to know, like, can go along with
it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because I think it's so, it's, well, I mean, tell me, like, when you think about what brought, because, I mean, obviously, I think we all have our own journeys that bring us into the realm of, like, sexual medicine, you know, and so sometimes it's because you grew up in a shame culture, like I did, or, you know, like some of these other things, you might have experienced it yourself, like I did as well. And so, like, you know, it's one of these things, and additionally, it's like you start seeing the patients over and over again, you don't know how to help them. So, like, what brought you into, like, saying, like, okay, I know I wanted to be a mental health therapist, but now I actually want to subspecialize and focus on sex.
Yeah. So when I was studying psychology in my early part of my career, I was really interested in mental health and, like, relationships and family patterns. I had had some early experiences that made me curious about that. But I was also really interested in health, and I was working in a public health center doing a lot of sexuality training. So I was teaching safer sex skills on college campuses, and I was also counseling folks and doing HIV testing. Okay. So we had this really great grant where students from the college wellness center could come in and get tested. Mm-hmm. And I found that people would come to these tests feeling really, really nervous. And it wasn't that they, like, you know, necessarily were nervous about, like, what the test meant per se, but it was more about the relationship that, like, led them there, right? Did somebody step outside of a relationship agreement and that's why they were there, or the results, right? And I felt like there was so much they were bringing beyond the safer sex piece of things that I didn't have the skills to counsel them on. And it just made me realize how sexuality is so much bigger and deeper than what we do with our bodies. And I felt really compelled to be able to work with folks in that way. I actually connected with a sexologist who became a mentor to me and sort of introduced me to the field of sex therapy, because at the time, what was it, 14 years ago or whenever this was, like, there wasn't really a whole training protocol for sex therapists. You kind of fell into the field, and now we're in a very different space. So that was sort of my origin story, is just realizing that I was really comfortable talking about this with people, and I was a void in a place where I could help, and it was just about getting the education and tools.
Yeah, because before it was like, you know, Masters and Johnson, figure out how to do it. Yeah, everyone's on.
I have a fun story about them, too, actually. One of my family members lives in a home that used to, the former residents worked with Masters and Johnson. Mm-hmm. And so they conducted therapy in this home in St. Louis. Yeah. And so there's, like, a side door. And when I first encountered this home, I was like, oh, my God, they used to do therapy in here, like, the den. And so, like, I tracked down, like, who it was. And so I have some colleagues in St. Louis who trained with this couple that used to live there, Ann Masters and Johnson. And I was like, okay, this is amazing like, you know, we're in full circle. So anyway, it was just such a fun, like, personal, professional moment.
Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah. Because, and you know, I think that, what was it, Showtime had a show about them, Masters of Sex or something like that?
Yeah, they did.
I didn't dive too deep into it, but I know it's sort of, like, probably really dramatized what was going on.
It did, but I also think it, like, right, it's anti-shaming, right? Because we're talking about this. And I think that's the thing that's so important. Like, I always see people, like, there's so many examples of therapy on television, right? And, like, some of them are, I think, kind of ludicrous and or you know, emphasized for dramatic effect. But ultimately, the more that we're talking about this, right, the, like, less that shame continues to grow. And I think it's important for, you know, it's 2025 and there are more people seeking sex therapy now than ever before, right? And that's not an accident. It's because we're talking about it. It's because our field is growing. Yeah. You know, same with sexual medicine, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's just, more people are on social media talking about even. And there's actually a lot more groups of, patient advocates, like the patients who had been historically gaslit or had a hard time are now advocating for other patients. And so I think that's really, really important. I mean, so you're really talking about, like, unlearning shame. So there might be, I mean, we see it all the time where you have, like, physical pain and avoidance. And really a disconnect from pleasure in and of itself because of a lot of this, and it's rooted sort of in more of the emotional stuff. Do you think people can unlearn the shame that they've carried for so long?
I mean, I absolutely think that. I've seen it happen in my office. I think it's really rewarding to be able to help folks do that work, you know, recognizing that they deserve pleasure and that they're also, even saying the word pleasure can be really activating for people. Mm-hmm. So like finding the language of like, how do we describe wanting something for ourselves when we're taught that like our body or our existence is in service of like a lot of other people? This is something I see a lot with women. Yeah. So, you know, it's definitely something that can be overcome. And I think it's really cool to help people do that, but it is work. It's not something that's like, you know, super quick usually.
Yeah. And I think that whole idea of, you know, that your body is for service or pleasure shouldn't be sought. It's like, I was talking to somebody and I was just about how the number of people that fake orgasms, like, you know, at some point in their life. And it's interesting because there's like no other condition where a woman would accept not getting something that's like, or anyone, right? Like if you had a bad meal, you wouldn't keep going after the same bad meal. Like you would say, okay, right. I'm not going to have this bad meal. I'm going to correct it. But like people can have like bad relationships and not be get pleasure during those encounters, and they keep faking it because they think that's what they're supposed to do, or that they're not, maybe they're not even supposed to have the pleasure, right? Like we just think that we're supposed to suffer as women, I think.
I think that's a message. And I think something since I work with a lot of couples, something I see a lot in relationships is fear about hurting my partner, right? I don't want to tell my partner that I've been faking an orgasm for our entire marriage, our entire relationship, because that's going to wreck them, right? Their self-confidence is going to be in the tank and I don't want to be responsible for that.
True.
And that's so hard. I think it's a tough pill to swallow. Like it's one thing when you're new in relationship and you can be a little bit more honest, there's not as much, but if there's like a lot of years there, I think that becomes a harder, you know, tougher.
I mean, that's a good, I think that's a good segue into a topic. I think that is so important for relationships of any type when it comes to sex, relations, communication, right? So, and that connection. Because, you know, obviously shame lives in our minds. It shows up in relationships and the communication barriers are so real. Like, what do you think the biggest barriers are? You said, obviously, like not being truthful about what you're fixing. Either, I mean, I'm sure some people are hiding the number of partners they have. Some people are over-exaggerating it, you know, like.
I think it's not being able to say that, like, what you want and also not asking, right? So when I think about culture, not just like broadly, but culture within a relationship. And when you get into an intimate relationship with someone, you establish a culture of like what's normative for us to talk about and what's on the table and what's off the table. And something simple of like, you know, maybe you have a sexual encounter and just being like, oh, like, how was that for you? That checking in, it's like, it's not a big question. I mean, it's not something that you need a doctoral degree to know to ask, right? But a lot of people don't do that, right? Because there's fear and vulnerability on the other side of that. And what if they didn't like it, right? And what if I can't handle that? And I don't want to talk about that. So I think it's like a lot of fear and not creating a culture of openness around this and like, you know, ongoing, I'm going to use the word feedback, not because it's like a corporate term, but just because we want to have open dialogue with partners. That's really key to being able to have a really good experience and satisfaction. And couples who can do that tend to have more satisfying relationships in my experience.
I mean, because we know that, you know, this is the kind of thing that for some couples, it makes or breaks them, right? Like it can be, you know, especially we know there's always usually, it's rare that you have libido that's, especially for midlife patients, I think like, you know, everyone has the same equal libido. There seems to be, you know, for most people, a libido mismatch. And it may not be the, you know, I see it all the time. It's not like my patient's desire to increase her libido a lot of times. Sometimes they do. They feel dead inside and they want to increase it. Other times it's like, I don't want to keep doing this to my partner. Like, I don't want to keep turning them away or trying to pretend like I'm sleeping or telling them not to touch me because it might spur on the next thing, you know?
Yeah, and it can create resentment. It can be really painful. I think a lot of people feel like they're not contributing to the relationship, or they're not getting the con like they're not nurturing their connection in the way that they either thought that they were supposed to or they used to. And so desire mismatch can be a really tricky thing. It's the most common thing I see in my practice as far as sex therapy with couples. And believe it or not, there's no like sexual dysfunction code that really applies to this, right? I wish that in some way we could have a term. I mean, we do have desire discrepancy or desire mismatch, but there's not like a code that's like, okay, this is really what's going on here, even though we know that to be true. So
What do
yeah,
you
it's a
do?
big
Like, what are
thing.
some of the tools you use in sex therapy for like helping to improve the communication or, getting, because we always know it's biopsychosocial, right? So like I can help with the bio part and, even talk to them about some of their social issues and psych issues, but bringing it all together, like how do you help them open up communication? What tools do you use in sex therapy that's different than, sort of cognitive behavioral therapy?
So the first thing we do is looking at, like, we do an assessment and we look at what are sort of the blocks to you wanting intimate, like to be close with your partner in that way. And sometimes it's not sex entirely. Sometimes it's like all types of physical touch are off limits, right? Or people feel really distant, or they're not emotion like communicating about emotions either. So we're looking at, like, what are the things that, like, in the moments where you have connected, what have helped with that? What are the things that have gotten in the way? And those span the biopsychosocial arena. And then from there, it's like looking at, like, building willingness, taking pressure off the table. So I have couples do a lot of what I would call, like, non-demand touching, which means that, like, let's say you're going to have, like, a hug for, I don't know, a minute or something, which is a long time to hug somebody and most people. And there's no expectation that anything other than a hug will happen. And I'll have couples decide, like, what kind of activity they want to use. I'll have them pick something that's, like, in the green zone is what I'll call it. So, like, if you think of a stoplight, there's green, yellow, red. Yellow's like a little bit, I'm not so sure. Red's, I don't want to do that. But green's usually a safe enough activity. So I'll have them start with, like, things that are in the green zone and basically engage in non-demand touch. So they know that they're going to do this. It's like not, there's no pressure associated with it leading to anything like sex, if that there's some stress there. And that once they start doing that and they feel some sort of success and self-efficacy around it, then we work up to other things. I've also used Sensate Focus to help couples. And that's a, for folks who aren't familiar, that's a kind of gradual technique of mindfulness with guided touch that helps partners basically, like, create space to focus on the sensations their bodies are feeling without focusing on the pressure or what's going to happen next and the monitoring of all the other stuff that gets in the way. So we do a lot of that, and then we talk about feedback and, like, how do you know if your partner is feeling turned on? What if they're turned off? Like, how would you know if, like, that was happening for you? And can you talk about that? And we practice role playing some of these things in session, and then they go home and they use those tools. So for some people, it's asking about, I want some privacy, or I want to know that, like, when you stroke my hair, you're not gonna, dig your fingernails into my neck or something because they're long, or whatever the thing is. Like, whatever the fears are, concerns are, we're kind of customizing it to the
Situation.
individuals. But
I mean, because what I see
yeah,
is,
those are a
especially
couple.
in like the midlife space where you have like the perimenopausal or menopausal woman that's really struggling with anxiety, depression, mood disruption, sleep disruption, stress, all the things trying to balance. Libido is bothersome. She wants it to be better, but it's kind of last priority for her. But she's now seeing like, okay, because I did this interview with someone recently about the meno divorce, right? Like the 60% of women who get divorced in menopause that's led by the menopausal woman. And so it's like, these patients are upset because if you ask them about their sex life, what does sex look like for you? What's happening here? And they're, you know what? Maybe I had sex once last year. So they're in a sexless marriage, right? By definition. And so then it becomes the farther you go from like actually having physical touch with the person that you are kind of roommates with at this point, almost, right? Roommates and maybe co-parenting. I think that's kind of the hardest thing for them to say, like, well, I don't even know. I mean, I don't even know where I'd start. Okay, say I have libido. Like, what? It just feels foreign to me now to actually want to be touched by that person.
100%. And so we work on small, like, baby steps, essentially. And not expecting it to feel natural. Because what if you used to lay and cuddle together before bed every single night, but you haven't touched your partner then that way in over a year? It's not going to feel the way that it used to feel. And expecting that and then feeling disappointed by it is going to frustrate the hell out of you. So, you know, we really work on like tempering expectations around that and also helping create willingness, because sometimes people don't go into a sexual experience with a whole lot of desire. They might just feel like, okay, I'm willing to do this and see what happens, but I don't actually feel like my libido is all that high right now. And that's pretty normal, right? We know a lot about responsive desire and how that works. So we do a lot of education around that too, and helping partners recognize that, like, just because you're showing up doesn't, as long as you're, you know, open and willing to be there, that doesn't mean that, like, this is wrong or a bad thing to, you know, start from this point. Mm-hmm. So that's something that we also work with couples on.
Yeah, because I think that's kind of the most intimidating, because everyone's like, well, you really should see a sex therapist too, if you guys, you know, as a couple, right? Most people come as couples.
I always see people separately, individually, like at the beginning, just to do a history. But if, like, sometimes I do see people individually. So, you know, if somebody's got like a lot of performance anxiety and that's creating stress in the relationship, they might want to work with me one-on-one first, and then they want to do some couples work. Or, you know, so I have other people on my team, so sometimes we'll cross collaborate. Like, I'll see one of the systems and they'll see one, and then that works out really well. So it just depends, like, on, you know, where people are at, and I'm always trying to meet them there first.
Yeah, of course. That's all you can do, right? That's like the biggest thing.
Right, exactly.
And so I think that all in well for now. And I love that you have this sort of platform for the next generation, right? Because I feel like that's really what is it, Building Ease, talking about the Birds and Bees course? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, yes.
That and the origin of that and what it's about.
Yeah, for sure. So I've always known that there's a link between education and, you know, what we learn and how that impacts our relationships. Mm-hmm. And I felt, you know, a lot of people come in and they just feel so massively unprepared for their sexual relationships. And that's actually a contributing factor to the concerns that they're having. And so what I really thought would be helpful is to be able to help with the parents and youth, right? Because when we start talking about these things early and often and not in a shaming or a fear-based way, it actually, what we find is that people are more prepared, mm-hmm. and it feels more normalized. Other countries do a really good job of this. Mm-hmm. If you look at like the Netherlands, yeah. in terms of how they approach sex ed, right? This might come up at dinner, yeah. right? Like on a random Tuesday, and it's like not a big deal to be able to talk about condoms or have them be in a bathroom. Like, you know, it's the same way that you might see like a tampon pad dispenser or hand soap, for, you know, things like that are necessary, yeah. in there. Yeah. So yeah, so I started to create a course. I started working with parents and teaching them, like, how do you approach your young people about these things? When do you say, you know, what do you say and when do you say it? And how do you start these conversations? Yeah. And then built a course that I launched about 5 years ago now. And I still do some parent coaching with folks who have questions. And I also give lectures and talks about this for clinicians as well.
Oh, very good. I love that. Because I think that's really crucial. I feel like, was it maybe 1 or 2 years ago at Ishwish, you know, there was some discussion on what, you know, what kids are doing in college these days. And I've had, you know, some people on the podcast as well talk about really how, you know, the types of sex people are having are not so, I mean, you know, there's more sort of what could be considered more kink, I guess, right? There's a lot more choking happening in sex, and there's a lot more of these other things. So I think even exposure to pornography and these things that kids are getting exposed to just right at their disposal, which, you know, wasn't the case in the past, has really skewed how they view it too, as well. What did you say? Have you seen that as well?
I have. I think, you know, what's happened is that with the absence of quality sex ed and without talking about it, people are going to, they're going to encounter porn, and then that's going to impact what they think about it unless they were taught otherwise. Now, if you have a trusted adult or somebody saying, hey, what you're going to see in pornography is not, you know, reflective of what's happening in real life, or, you know, it's very highly curated, or just be, you know, just kind of helping to have a little bit more conscientiousness around it, you know, that can certainly help. I'm not somebody who tends to be like anti-erotica, but I do think that when young people are absorbing this without any kind of guidance or support around it, that becomes pretty dangerous and or can be. And so that's really the work that I help parents with the most, is around like internet safety and talking about sexually, you know, oriented materials and how do we engage young people with these kinds of things, because they're probably, if they're not going to see it under your watch, they're going to see it on someone else's.
There's that book, Not My Child, I think it's called.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was talking to my son about it one day and he was just like, why are you talking to me? He was so appalled by it. But I was like, well, I just want you to know you can talk to me about, like, you know. And so I think he appreciated that later, but he was just like, I think sometimes because we live in this world of like sexual medicine, it's so desensitized to us that I think it's still a little bit. There's like a Netflix show about a sex therapist. Somebody told me about it.
Yeah, it's called Sex Education.
One of my patients like, you should see this. I'm sure this is how your kids are going to be.
The assumptions people make because of what we do, right? I think that's a big one too. But yeah, I totally hear you on that.
Do you think, like, I don't know if you see even, like, you know, you probably see young adults. I don't know how many teenagers or whatever you might see, but like, since that falls into more child sort of therapy, but do you see more people coming to you, like, even thinking they're asexual? Because I feel like that, I've seen that more than I would have expected. Like, sometimes we think it's low libido, and then they'll work with one of my sex therapists, one of you, or whoever else, and they realize, actually, I'm just asexual. And that's okay, too. At least I can accept the fact that this has never been who I am.
Yeah. It's definitely something that's, I think we've developed more language around in the last several years. So I'm seeing it more. It's not like a huge population of the folks I see, but I definitely do have people wondering, you know, especially for folks who have lower desire, like, is it the low desire? Is it that I'm asexual? Am I demisexual or gray sexual? There's all these terms now to describe all the ways in which we may identify. And I think, you know, one of the things I'm helping people with is like, what is their distress level around desire? Have they ever experienced it? Because when it's an identity piece, it's different than when we, you know, just we want to have desire, but we don't, we feel stressed by that. So definitely something that's coming up more. And I feel like it's good that there are more resources now around that topic too.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's very helpful too. And I think, you know, even I've read statistically, like, younger adults are having like less sex than like you would have expected. I don't know if it's because they're just all consumed with social, like, they'd rather be doom scrolling or whatever. Mm-hmm. That
could, yeah. But I think it's also of, like, I've heard a lot of people feel worried about access to, like, you know, safer sex and birth control and contraception and things like that. And so feeling worried of, like, well, I don't want to get pregnant or I don't want to get an STI. And so, like, avoiding sex for that reason, especially with everything with, like, Roe versus Wade. Like, I think there was a good population of people I had noticed, particularly, like, I would say Gen Z or younger, like, around then, that were like, okay, I'm just not. And then I think for kind of millennial Gen X, it's more of like life stressors is impacting that, right? People are so strapped, mental load is so full, so high that, like, sex becomes offloaded or, like, deprioritized in many ways. And so I think those are the things that I see contributing to lack of interest in sex. And then, of course, the pandemic, right? If you were, like, a college student during pandemic, you probably were not as sexually active than somebody who maybe at that cohort now.
Yeah. That's so true, actually. It'll be interesting to see how the pandemic, like, once they get 10 years of more data, like, how it really impact mental health and sexual health and all the things that we think about, because I think it's going to be pretty pronounced and we just don't even really.
Oh, yeah. I'm already starting to see some early effects, but, you know, I think it's such anecdotal data. I would love to hear what they find.
Yeah, eventually, yeah. Jennifer, I do this thing on, so my husband's kind of like made a joke once that my listeners are like vagilantes. So I do this thing called a vagilante verdict, which is your hot take. Like, what's your hot take that you want people to remember or listen, you know, or to know?
I think that, like, you know, the more that we are bringing sex into our relationships, of all of our relationships, like, the better, right? We're working on undoing that shame. We're making it, like, more accessible to be able to talk about, feeling less alone. So I think that, like, normalizing bringing up one's sex life and, you know, any kind of conversation is really important. Like, I was at a networking event the other day and we were talking about smutty literature and it was a diverse crowd. And like, I think it's just great to be able to bring these things to the table. And yeah, like it might seem a little bit countercultural or, novel, but it normalizes it. And we ended up talking about, like, I think the conversation was like, what do you like to read? And some people were talking about romance and how that can be really powerful. So that's my hot take, is that there's no wrong place to necessarily talk about these things.
Oh, I just love it. I love it. Well, I mean, I appreciate you coming on today and giving us some insight into your world of sex therapy. And, you know, people have their misconceptions, like, what is sex therapy? Like, I'm sure that, you know, you hear about it all the time. Like, what does that mean?
Yes.
Don't watch me have sex.
Right. So, and those shows did actually confuse people, right?
Right. to their point, yeah. Maybe that's was understanding what sex was at the time and the
100%.
The different sort of stages. But anyway, I appreciate you being on today. I'm going to make sure in the show notes, everyone knows where they can find you, and on Instagram and also in Chicago. Are you licensed in any other states?
I am licensed in Louisiana and Idaho as well. And then I have some staff who are licensed in Indiana and Kansas too. So,
okay. Yes, that's what I said. Okay. Awesome. So we'll put all that in the show notes. And thanks for coming on. And we'll have to do this again because there's so much more we can talk about. But, we have to, I like to keep our show limited so that people can actually get through the whole thing. Because I find that, you know, the longer the episodes are, sometimes people have a hard time, like, staying on path there.
So. Oh, totally. If you can fit into like a commute of some kind, that's the right amount, right? But if you're driving more than 30 minutes, you're probably losing us.
I don't know what she's hopping in because I got out of my car.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. Thanks everyone that's listened today to this episode. Please like and subscribe to my podcast and leave me a review. I'm Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Thanks for listening to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Remember, I'm here to educate so you can advocate for yourself. Please join me next week.
If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear. To get more information, my practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.